From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Leg Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, if everyone is a journalist now, then at least one professor of journalism thinks we should all be subject to the same set of ethics. Then, data mining is a huge business for both governments and corporations, and the ACLU says that threatens our individual autonomy.
We are increasingly sliced and diced by the large institutions that we deal with. We're increasingly pigeonholed into categories. We're rated and ranked and sifted and sorted in ways that help them but don't help us.
And scientific insight seldom follows a straight path.
You think you know what the data is going to be. You think you know what's going to come out of it. And sometimes you get a little bit of that, but often you get a surprise.
But it's no surprise that Lake Effect comes your way next. But first, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Most of what you listen to on this radio station constitutes journalism. There are different forms. Morning Edition is different from Lake Effect, which is different from Here and Now. But at the heart of what we all do as reporters and producers is a set of ethics. Those ethics include what we provide our listeners and how we treat other journalists and media outlets. But do you think of yourself as a journalist? Kelly McBride argues it's time for all of us to start thinking of media ethics, whether we're hosting a radio show or posting a video to YouTube. McBride is a senior faculty member in ethics reporting and writing at the Poynter Institute, a training and education center for journalists in Florida, and she's one of the nation's leading voices on media ethics issues. McBride was in Milwaukee this week to talk about ethics for an audience at Marquette University. Before that, she spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about how the sheer number of journalists in the 21st century affects the nature of media ethics.
I think there's something fundamentally different. We are living in a world now where the consumers of information are also creators of information. So it's not just that some of us can be journalists. We can all be journalists. And the thing about that is it means that the audience changes its ideas about what it finds valuable. So, I mean, and this is just one little example. It used to be that independence was really valuable to the audience, independence in the voice of the information provider. And that's because there were so few information providers. In any given city, there was a couple of newspapers and maybe a radio station and then later on television. But really, you could count them on one hand in most cities. And so in that case, when you only had five reliable sources of information, you wanted those sources to be neutral. You wanted them to be independent because if they weren't, they were likely to skew the way democracy worked. Well, these days, you have millions of sources of information. And so independence isn't nearly as important to the audience as it used to be. Now, transparency is way more important. People aren't necessarily concerned if you have a dog in the fight or if you're taking sides, but they want to know that information ahead of time.
Does that change what the ethics are, or does it change what the questions about the ethics are? I mean, I guess do ethics exist in a vacuum, or are they determined by the consumers of this stuff?
Well, I mean, I think you're talking about two sides of the same coin here, really. Because journalism is an unlicensed profession, we don't determine our ethics in some ivory tower and then impose them on everybody who holds the license the way accountants and doctors and lawyers do. Instead, we look to see what the audience finds useful, and we try and articulate those best practices and import them back into the practitioners. So it's really a ground up system of ethics. And let me say, there's another factor here, and that's the business concerns. Because the business concerns determine our ethics almost as much as the audience does. And even for that independence example that I just used, it was mutually beneficial to the business side of journalism to be independent. If you could aggregate a wide audience, then you could sell that audience to an advertiser. Now that the economic models are crumbling in journalism, that's another pressure that's changing our ethical considerations.
So this is the idea that there are some advertisers who would seek to be associated with an outlet that has a particular bent one way or the other.
Right. I mean, that was one idea. But the reality is now that advertising just isn't working the same way it used to. Advertising is no longer looking for the widest possible audience. They're looking for the most engaged audience. And that means different things to different advertisers. It means different things on different platforms. And so the changes in the economic model, that's changing how we describe our mission as journalists as much as the technological changes in the audience habits changing as well.
Are there things about ethics that haven't changed? Are there fundamental parts of what it is to be a journalist that really are exactly the same in 2014 as they were in 1914?
Well, sure. Let's start with telling the truth, right? Like, that's pretty important. that was always part of the fundamental ethical principles of every journalism code that I've ever seen, those that I've participated in writing. And that tends to be the first principle always, always, always. Seek the truth and report it as fully as possible. That's one way of articulating it. Tell the truth. And to the extent that we can find these other pressures causing journalism organizations to not tell the truth or to distort the truth, I'm very comfortable saying, you know what, that's unethical. When your business pressures cause you to distort the truth, when your desire to please the audience causes you to distort the truth, or when your conception of fairness or equivalency – so this actually happens all the time where you'll have a journalist say, well, I got to get both sides of this issue. But both sides may not be equal. There may be facts on one side and not on the other, and you don't have to treat those as both equal. Global warming is the classic example where journalists are finally coming to terms with the idea that there's actual science on this issue and that you need to pay attention to that science and that you can't allow a weatherman to go up against a climate change expert.
I wonder also if because there are so many more outlets than there once were, so many more people who think of themselves as journalists, are the ethics of how we work within the industry, how we treat each other as journalists, a greater part of the equation than they once were?
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're trying to describe is the media ecosystem. And it used to be that you had this this foundation of journalists who created the original content. And newspapers were at the very core of that foundation. So in cities all across the country, you had small and medium-sized newspapers that set the agenda of the topics of the day for the community. And radio and television stations tended to riff off the newspapers. Not always. Sometimes they sought their own stories, but often they reflected upon and amplified what the newspapers were already doing. And then you had these national organizations like the Associated Press and the New York Times and the broadcast television stations that sorted through all that local content and elevated some of it to national conversation. That's not what happens anymore. Now you have a smaller number of people creating original content, and you have even more people and organizations creating opinion based on that original content, and sometimes not based on that original content at all, sometimes just creating opinion. So we have a lot more opinion and commentary in the marketplace of ideas right now. We have fewer organizations and fewer individuals that are devoted to identifying and surfacing new facts and new information.
Do you get calls from the right people, do you think, as an ethics expert? I mean, are you really in a position where the kinds of journalists you work with are most of the way there simply because they're actually thinking in terms of ethics?
Well, I get a lot of calls. So But I certainly – my phone doesn't ring all day. If the right people were calling me for advice, I wouldn't be able to handle it because every decision that a journalist makes is an ethical decision. It has ethical implications. And for the most part, I think that journalists and journalism organizations have a pretty good understanding of what their mission is and how they serve that mission in an ethical way. However, I think that most news organizations are operating on a much faster clip than they used to. And so they occasionally forget to think about things because they're moving so fast. And the business pressures are challenging news organizations to find new sources of revenue. And sometimes they don't think all the way through it. You know, so we had an example, native advertising is a big, big news source of revenue. And this is where a news organization creates content that looks and smells and acts like it's regular content, but it's somehow branded sponsored content or native advertising. The Atlantic did this with a piece for the Church of Scientology, and the audience went nuts because they felt like it wasn't transparent enough, and that particular topic was so controversial that they didn't appreciate the Atlantic, which is a very good journalistic organization, allowing an advertiser to create something that felt like a dupe. It felt like they were tricking the audience. So that's one example. And I think that news organizations are dealing with big and small pressures like that every single day. And for the most part, they don't have to call me. They don't have to call an ethics expert. But what they do have to do is stop and ask questions about what they're doing and how that reflects their core set of values.
Well, and as you said, this is not a case where ethics are created in this ivory tower and are policed by some absolute authority. Do you think – is it a good thing that we as consumers of media are the ultimate police of ethical considerations in what we consume?
Well, it's a very democratic thing, right? I mean, we live in a country that has a First Amendment that guarantees the right to a free press. And what that really means is that you can publish any idea at all into the marketplace of ideas, and your right to do that is guaranteed. So we have remedies for when that becomes harmful in the civil courts, and we have very few restrictions when publishing something can cause great harm to society, like shouting fire in a theater or something like that. But for the most part, we live in this world that allows that. And the benefits of that, the democratic benefits of that, I believe far outweigh all of the harmful manifestations that we are experiencing now. And you have to remember that amendment was written at a time when the press was crazy irresponsible. I mean, they were publishing things that were patently false and biased and carrying hidden political agendas. And so that speech was meant to be protected. Bad speech is as protected as good speech. And so that's the world that we live in. Now, if we really want democracy to thrive, that means that we – because if you go back to – consumers are also creators of content. That means that all of us citizens now have some sort of responsibility to develop a set of news literacy skills and to be responsible in what we publish and what we distribute. So that means, you know, the crazy stuff you pass along on your Facebook page or the crazy emails that you send along. You have the same obligation that the professional journalist has to be responsible with that information.
Even if we don't think right off the bat what we're doing is journalism, we actually are committing acts of journalism.
Absolutely. And an act of journalism, it's really hard to define who is a journalist these days. In fact, I can't do it. I've tried and I can't do it. I can tell you who gets a paycheck for doing journalism, but I can't tell you who a journalist is. And that's because sometimes we create content that acts as journalism. And by acting as journalism, what I mean is the information allows others to fulfill their civic duties, to understand their communities, to understand an issue, or to carry out their democratic obligations.
Even if we don't necessarily think of what we're doing as journalism, other people are treating it that way. And so this is something that ought to be on our minds when we post something to YouTube.
Right, right. And I mean, the other thing is that we actually have developed a pretty good sorting system right now. I once posted a picture of an alligator, right? So I live in Florida, and I posted a picture of an alligator that I believed to be a 28-foot alligator. And that was the story that I posted underneath it. And it was a matter of seconds before the people on my Facebook page pointed out that that was undoubtedly fake. And they linked to the Snopes site that examined the photo and verified that it was fake. And then they pointed out to me that, like, alligators only get to be 15 feet tops, you know, that 28 feet was a little ridiculous and I maybe was spending too much time at Disney World. So I don't think we have to bear all this responsibility by ourselves, although it's important to keep these duties and obligations in mind. But we have each other to help us out. And that's actually what happens in newsrooms, right? Like you don't expect one person to bear the entire burden of telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's a communal effort. And so we do need to think about this both individually and as a community.
If only we could send our Facebook posts through a group of fact checkers before they went up.
Yeah. The thing is you can, but it's after they go up.
Kelly McBride, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Kelly McBride is a senior faculty member in ethics, reporting, and writing at the Poynter Institute in Florida. She's also co-editor of the recent book, The New Ethics of Journalism, Principles for the 21st Century. She spoke with Mitch Teich this week while she was in Milwaukee to give the Burleigh Media Ethics Lecture at Marquette University. Coming up next on Lake Effect, Big Brother is watching you. Or perhaps we should say Big Brothers. From governments to corporations, there isn't much privacy out there anymore. Well, the ACLU is working to reverse that, and we'll talk with one of its senior analysts next. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. In a more innocent time, most of us in the United States assumed that unless we were breaking the law, our communications were private. The Fourth Amendment gives citizens protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, and it also gives the people the right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Most of us assumed that included emails, texts, and telephone conversations. Well, turns out, not so much. Data collection has been making headlines in the past few years as revelations that both government agencies and multinational corporations have legally gotten their hands on plenty of our communications. And depending on who's doing the collecting, they justify it by saying they're using it to stop terrorism or to better connect us to the stuff they think we'll want to buy. Jay Stanley is a senior policy analyst with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and his area of specialty is in technology-related privacy and civil liberties issues. He was in Milwaukee last week to speak at UWM's Institute of World Affairs, and he joined me in the studio then. Jay, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
We've heard the phrase big pharma, and you talk about big data. What is big data, and who is it?
Kind of means several different things. On the broadest level, it just sort of is a reference to the fact that a bunch of people, a bunch of organizations, institutions are collecting a lot of information about us now. It also refers to the companies, kind of like big oil, big data, the companies that do this, everybody from Google to data aggregator companies. This is a multi-billion dollar industry that a lot of Americans aren't even aware of, like Axiom, that collect as much information on as many individuals as they can and build sort of dossiers on us in order to sell it for marketing purposes. And they might know a range of stuff from your income and your demographic information to health information about you, educational information, purchasing information, your interests. And so, you know, there's this industry, and that's what the term refers to. And there's also a little bit more of a specific meaning to the term big data, which refers to the fact that when you get these really giant databases, you can mine them for statistical correlations that might not be obvious at the outset.
Such as?
Well, one of the big examples that's come to public attention is what Target Corporation has been doing. So Target has loads and loads of information about, you know, millions and millions of customers at all the Target stores around America. And they have data miners who look through this trying to find patterns and correlations that can give them an edge. And one of their data miners found that there are about 15 to 20 products that when you buy them are a very good indicator that you're probably pregnant. And they can even guess to a pretty good degree when your due date is. In fact, there was a gentleman who came into a Target store, according to this story, which was all reported in the New York Times Magazine, and he was all upset. He's like, my 16-year-old daughter just got this flyer from you advertising baby products. What are you trying to encourage her to have sex at a young age? This is totally inappropriate. And the manager didn't know what was going on. He apologized. He called him back and apologized. And then the father called him back a week later and said, well, I guess there were some things going on in my household that I didn't know about. Turns out you were right.
So the data mining had actually predicted this.
The data mining had identified his daughter as someone who was pregnant, and Target knew that she was pregnant before her father did.
So I find it interesting. Big data seems to be not just government as the big data, the big brother kind of thing, or NSA mm-hmm. doing that kind of spying. But you're saying this is even more corporate, and this is much more marketing and trying to sell us product.
Well, I think that it's both. There's no question that the government is also engaged in big data of certain types. We have learned a lot in recent months about the National Security Agency and all the information that they're collecting. We don't know to what extent they use these sort of statistical data mining techniques. But, you know, the idea has definitely been circulating throughout the national security establishment since at least the early Bush administration that maybe the way that Target identifies pregnant people, we could use this data to identify terrorists. This idea is very frightening because it would set the government on the road to collecting as much information as it can about as many of us as it can and sifting through ordinary people's lives in order to try and detect those who are, quote unquote, suspicious.
There are those who say they're already doing that, you know, that they're already on that road. The government is on that road.
I think they are on that road. We don't know exactly what extent. There was a program called Total Information Awareness that was proposed in the first Bush administration that would have done this, and it was highly controversial. We at the ACLU opposed it vociferously and with congressional allies on the left and the right. And eventually Congress shut it down and barred the DARPA, which is the research arm of the Pentagon, from doing further research on this. But there was a little thing that said that they could move it to the NSA. And so we think that it just went underground in the NSA.
Well, does the ACLU find any appreciable difference between, say, government collecting data and big corporations like Google or Amazon or Axiom aggregating data?
At one level, the government collecting data is scarier. The government has the power to put you in jail. They have the power to put you on a watch list so that when you fly overseas, you can't get back to your country. We've filed a lawsuit on behalf of people in that situation. And Google does not have the power to put you in jail yet. But on another level, there's increasingly – it's a distinction without a difference. I wrote a paper in 2004 called The Surveillance Industrial Complex that talks about how government data collection, data mining, and private sector data collection and data mining are often dovetailing with each other and working together. You know, most Americans' interactions are with companies, not with the government. And companies collect a lot of details about how Americans live their lives. And the government sometimes gets that data. Sometimes they buy it. Sometimes they order the companies when they have the power to do so, which was greatly expanded by the Patriot Act and other legislation. And sometimes they actually can order the companies to keep information that the companies might not otherwise want to keep. And we see that in the banking sector, for example. So there are a lot of ways in which the two work together.
You've written that the massive collection of data is a shifting of power away from the individual toward large institutions like governments or corporations. It's kind of obvious that if our privacy is impinged upon enough where people can infer by looking at my phone records what might be wrong with me or what I might be considering doing, that's definitely an intrusion into my privacy. But how does this shift of power away from an individual toward these bigger groups threaten individual autonomy?
Well, I think that the danger is that we are increasingly sliced and diced by the large institutions that we deal with. We're increasingly pigeonholed into categories. We're rated and ranked and sifted and sorted in ways that help them but don't help us, that confine our choices in life. If a company has insight into what you're interested in buying, what you can afford to buy, how knowledgeable you are about a marketplace, what your fears are, they can manipulate you. They can sell things to you better. They can make more money off of you. And that is something that can only help them and can't really help you. And then there's also the danger that this kind of data mining will accentuate power differences that already exist between different groups. For example, if you're somebody who's privileged and you have a stellar resume and record and you're doing well financially, then you might get a lot of offers because companies want you as their customer. Whereas if you're somebody who has some mistakes in your life, maybe you have a criminal record or a bad credit rating or what have you, then suddenly you get less good offers. And so the benefits go to those who need them least, and the people who most need new chances in life are the least likely to get them.
You also have talked about fair information practice principles, and it sounds like this is a perfect time to bring that up. What are they, and why does the United States not adhere to them?
So the Fair Information Practice Principles, often called FIPS, are sort of the gold standard for good, fair privacy around the world. They were actually developed in the U.S. in the 1970s and taken up around the world, including by just about every advanced industrial OECD nation except the United States. And they include purpose specification, that when you collect information from people, you need to specify why you're collecting that information. Notice purpose specification and then use limitation. If you collect information for one purpose, you can't use it for another purpose without going back and asking the permission of the data subject. And those are in some ways the three key principles in the Fair Information Practice Principles. But having those kind of principles in law, even a broad law where a lot of the applications had to be worked out, would be tremendously important. And it's something that's in effect in Europe and other countries. And it really shifts the burden of proof for how new technologies are used and how companies track and sort people.
What kind of institution would you like to see enforcing something like that?
Well, most of the European and other countries around the world have a privacy commissioner. In many countries, the privacy commissioner has the, for example, in Italy, march into the Italian equivalent of the CIA and the NSA and look at whatever they want to look at and conduct oversight just to make sure there aren't shenanigans going on. They have the ability to order halts to certain practices that are violating their privacy laws, subpoena power and so forth. And we don't have anything like that. We do have a new institution called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is something that should be watched. It's very significant. It was actually enacted in the Bush administration, I believe it was 2007, by Congress, and it's created as an independent agency like the FTC or the FAA. But Bush and the Democrats in Congress couldn't agree on who to appoint to it, so it never got filled during the Bush administration. Then when President Obama came along, we thought, okay, there goes the partisan conflict. Now we'll see the board filled. But then President Obama didn't appoint anybody to it for the entire first term because I think that the executive branch just does not want an independent oversight body, not part of the White House script, that can step on their message, that can make news in ways that the White House doesn't have control over.
So it's there, but it's not.
It was there, but it was not. But it finally, after a lot of pressure and letters from senators to the White House saying, when are you going to appoint these commissioners? It finally came into existence about a year ago, 9 months ago, just in time for the Edward Snowden revelations. And they have actually been investigating the NSA's activities, and they issued a report pretty critical of a lot of the programs that Edward Snowden had revealed. And they are currently working on another report. So they're a very small institution. I mean, our national security establishment is a huge institution. The intelligence community is like $60 billion. There's 30,000 people who work at the NSA and an equivalent number at the CIA, I believe. And yet the oversight institutions over this gigantic establishment are relatively puny. You have some two committees in Congress, the Intel committees and their staffers. And a lot of the Intel committee seems to be more interested in protecting than overseeing when it comes to these programs. So I think a lot of the oversight over this gigantic establishment has – I mean, we're fortunate as Americans in that we have national values that we've had for 200 years. And when any large institution begins to violate those values, you can depend on some brave person coming forward and blowing the whistle. I mean, that's what we've seen in this case.
It seems that what you're saying is that we don't really have any sort of recourse in place to be able to monitor in the – and we're talking about the government here. We're not talking about corporations right now, which is a whole nother – as we were saying earlier, another part of the sort of the privacy impingement. But there doesn't seem to be any way for someone like a Snowden to do anything but what he did and to do it in that sort of leak way and then basically leave the country. And it sounds like in order to protect our privacy, we need to have other mechanisms in place. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's right. I think that we do have some whistleblower protection laws in place, but the NSA is exempt from them. And certainly as a matter of practice, anybody who wanders off the team in any way finds themselves treated very, very poorly and basically has to be ready to lose their career and possibly their life savings and their house. And that's not something that most people are willing to do. And yet I think that having an outlet for whistleblowers is one of the great strengths of our country. It's one of the great checks and balances against abuse by these giant machines. These big security bureaucracies are like machines. They're like the sorcerer's apprentice. Once you set them in motion, they'll keep rolling along, and they're full of many good, hardworking people who are out to protect our country and do the best that they can. But when you get tens of thousands of people together into a giant bureaucracy, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Let's take it back to individuals, because that's where we started, thinking about the technologies that we use and depend on, like mobile phones, like GPS, like your EasyPass toll payment system. We don't want to give those things up. We don't want to go back to not having a mobile phone that I can Skype around the world with. But it seems like we are paying a huge price in privacy for that, because our movements can be tracked. All kinds of privacy invasions can happen. How do we balance those two things? What would the ACLU like to see as a perfect balance in a perfect world?
First of all, I mean, sometimes we're accused of being anti-technology. We love technology. I love living in the future. I love my cell phone. I love all these things. They're excellent. They're great. But I want my cake and eat it too. And I feel like Americans should be able to have their cake and eat it too. And there's no reason they can't have both the convenience and the high technology and the coolness and the empowering access to information that we all love so much, and have our privacy protected. Some people say to me, oh, you know, you can't stop technology. There's nothing you can do about this. And I often point to surveillance cameras. We have surveillance cameras in many of our public spaces around the U.S., and we at the ACLU don't love public video surveillance, and we've warned against excessive public video surveillance. But for all the millions of cameras that are out there in America, none of them have microphones. And it's not because microphones are expensive or difficult. It's because our wiretapping laws make it legally problematic to audio tape things in public places. We took our values, we put an expression of our values of preserving privacy, and we put them into our laws, and they have shaped how the technology has rolled out all across the nation. And so I think that you can enjoy technology, but you can set some limits and some rules and some principles in place and say you can go and innovate and do as much as you want, but you have to understand that there are some limits. Right now, we have an enormous online advertising industry that's building a gigantic infrastructure for spying and tracking on Americans. And all of the full fury and genius of American capitalism is increasingly being dedicated and focused on how to spy on Americans. It's corporate spying. Do we want a huge corporate sector competing on who can spy best on Americans? I think that we need to set some boundaries and say, go innovate and graze these pastures, but we're going to put a little fence around this area, and we don't want you to compete on this measure.
I would say, has the horse already left the barn? Are we closing the door too late?
The horse is well out of the barn, but I think that we can put it back in. I think that there's never going to be a point where advertising companies say, okay, we've innovated enough in how to collect information. They're going to keep competing with each other. They're going to keep trying to find more and more intrusive ways and advanced ways to find out things about us and about our personal lives. And if they get to the next step, they're going to want to go one more step beyond that. And where is it going to stop? At a certain point, we have to say enough. You need to stop competing on this level. And even if the things that are currently in place aren't rolled back as we think they should be, then at least we can put a stop to further intrusions.
So ever vigilant.
Ever vigilant. And putting in place things like the Fair Information Practice Principles into a good overarching privacy law would go a long way to solving a lot of those problems in the corporate sector.
Well, Jay Stanley, we could talk for hours about this, but I want to thank you so much for your time today. It has been such a pleasure having you in the studio.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you.
Jay Stanley is a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberty Union's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He researches, writes, and speaks about current and future technology-related privacy and civil liberties issues. He was in Milwaukee last week to meet with students in UWM's Institute of World Affairs, and he spoke with us then. We'll take a short break now, and then coming up, contributor Gene Creighton joins us to talk about how astronomical data is collected, analyzed, and then published. Lake Effect returns with that conversation next on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is a pleasure to have you with us this morning, and it is a pleasure to have Gene Creighton in the studio with us this morning as well. Hello, Gene.
Hello, Bonnie.
It is wonderful to see you, and always look forward to our conversations. And today I wanted to start with basically what is the bread and butter for all scientists, and that is data. the way I understand it, it's how you do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does this work with astronomy? Over the months, the years that we've been doing this, we've talked about, you know, getting data from different kinds of telescopes, different kinds of instruments. So maybe let's talk about it itself. How do we go about collecting this stuff and determining what's important?
Great question. I was thinking it might be fun to talk about this from the point of view of somebody who's kind of new to the field, say, for example, a graduate student, or a person, a scientist who used to do specific research in this field but now has moved to a different subfield. And as it's very clear when you read the Astrophysical Journal, people specialize in small pieces of the overall picture just because we know so much about so much. It's hard to become an expert in very large areas of expertise. I remember when I was a graduate student reading journals and it seemed like a foreign language. Things would be explained with terms that I didn't know, so you'd have to go to that reference and read about that, and then in that paper there'd be other things that you'd never heard of before, and it really was like reading, you know, a newspaper in a foreign language where there's so many words you don't know that you kind of have to go back and back and back to the basics that you recognize and understand. Well, after you do that for a few months, then you start getting a better sense of what has been done in the field, because naturally sometimes the questions that you have about certain topics, let's say star formation, well, they've been asked before, and there's a healthy literature on those topics. So the next task then becomes, of the problems that you're wondering about, which ones have already been attempted? And in some cases, the response is fairly conclusive, and we all agree, yep, that's how it should be. But sometimes the issue might be supposedly concluded, but you might think that, oh, I bring a different perspective to this question, and maybe I can add something new.
To the body of knowledge.
Yeah. And that my perspective changes the way I would ask the question or try and answer the question, and therefore come up with a slightly more nuanced response. So different perspectives can be, I'm used to using different instruments. So, for example, well, maybe for this star-forming region, all the data is in the infrared, but what would happen if I started looking in X-rays, for example? Or what would happen if I used a different resolution of telescope? So sometimes it's a matter of using different eyes or a finer, if you will, a smaller pixel in your picture, or I need more data points. So there are a lot of now surveys in the sky that take pictures of large regions repeatedly. And sometimes that indicates that things change in ways that we didn't even appreciate because nobody was looking often enough to see those changes.
Now, if you're that new graduate student who's trying to find something to specialize in or a question that hasn't been answered, I'm assuming that professors and other more advanced people in the field are going to be able to direct you to some of this data
because they're
going to be able to say, well, no, that actually has been asked just like that by so-and-so.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. No, and certainly that's why, I mean, I think graduate students don't exist in vacuum. They usually are in an academic environment, so they can benefit from the context that the more experienced people would have. I think that's one of the most common problems with a graduate student's first steps is that you really don't know all the context that your research falls in. So you think you are all caught up in this little problem, but you don't realize always what the bigger picture is. And the bigger picture comes as you do more work yourself, as you become more aware in conferences or in just private communications what other people are working on.
I know there's a lot that we already know. But there's, of course, so much more to learn, probably infinity of things to learn out there. How do you decide when you're a graduate student? Do you get the direction from your advisor that basically says, you know, you really should push your interest in this direction because nobody's really doing that?
Well, I think there are a couple of considerations. One is what is considered you know, a hot topic or an interesting topic. So not all problems are equal in importance. So certain topics, like say, for example, if you can come up with good ideas about how whole galaxies form, well, that's a pretty interesting problem, or exactly the details of how the solar system has come to be the way it is, especially considering all the other solar systems we're finding beyond our own. These are really big questions, and they seem to attract the attention of many people, which usually means that funding comes with that, that you can get publications, that you can get, you know, you get invited to conferences to give talks. Obviously, some questions are a little more obscure, and in those situations, you don't have the same kind of resources. So sometimes people choose to go for the big time, although sometimes the big problems are harder to crack, and it might take a longer time for you to make that real progress. Or people choose the smaller, more doable problems that might not have the same glamour, but they might be more attainable. Does okay. that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. One of the things that would daunt me would be just the sheer volume of data that's there to go through, even if you're narrowing your specialty down. But if you're a cosmologist, say, mm-hmm. that's your job, is to understand the whole thing.
Right. But I think I think just starting with small little pieces like, let's read this paper, let's understand what it basically says, is overwhelming in and of itself. I don't think that graduate students, and it's probably just as well, sit there and ponder how much they don't know, because that really would make you, I think, run for the hills. But what is true is that sometimes there's quite a bit of luck involved. So, for example, when you're working with somebody, chances are they have some data that they would love to analyze, but they simply don't have time. So sometimes a project lands in your lap and you're trying to analyze the data and make sense of it. And that might be exactly what you say, oh, this is totally cool. This is what I want to do. This is the sort of project I'm interested in. Or you might say, okay, well, I'm happy to wrap this up. I want to finish the analysis, write the paper, but I know now this is not the kind of problem that I'm interested in. But it's nice to get your feet wet.
And also, to add to the body of knowledge, mm-hmm. because somebody else might build on that.
Oh,
or take it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any paper that is of no consequence to anybody, but some papers might be referenced, you know, in, say, 10 years, 5 times, and some papers could be referenced in 5 years, 2,000 times. Obviously, they're not of the same importance to the community overall. So for most people, eventually, you don't have data that's sitting around. Eventually, you have to actually get this data. And normally, that involves talking to researching observatories that have the kind of sensitivity or wavelength or all of the above that you require. And then you put in a proposal. You write an observing proposal and say, this is the data that I would like. This is the kind of questions that I'm going to ask. Here's how am I going to analyze the data. And these are all the lovely papers that I've written in the past so that you believe that I will actually do something with this data. Most telescopes are oversubscribed, in some cases 3-1, in some cases 10-1. So that means that all things being equal, your chances of getting time are 30% probably at best in most facilities, in some cases 10% at best. So then you wait usually for typically a few months, and the time allocation committee for that facility will decide whether your problem is interesting enough, whether it's feasible, because you could propose something marvelous that they think actually realistically this instrument can't do, how likely you are to publish. And of course, they know already if somebody has collected the very data that you proposed already. Usually an author, so the principal investigator for the data, will have a full year of lead time before the data becomes public. And that's to put some pressure on the author, some urgency that you need to write the paper before you get scooped, because if the data becomes public in principle, somebody else could do the analysis that you were hoping to do, and it's gone.
And
they published first. In the happy event that you get the paper and you analyze it,
you start to actually, as you're writing the paper or doing the analysis, you're probably talking to colleagues to get a sense of, you know, are there things that you might have overlooked? Sometimes, you know, over coffee, people will say, oh, did you consider da-da-da? And you feel like a fool because you think, no, I didn't consider that. Or sometimes you think, oh, yeah, I did consider that, but la, 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 la. And now you can, you know, discuss with some, in some detail with this person the marvelous thoughts that you had on the topic. Eventually, as you think more through the details of your research, then you can present it at conferences. And of course, you write the papers, which means that the next time you look for data, you have a stronger position. And of course, most often the data that you collect will generate new questions and the story continues.
Usually it just doesn't end. There's going to be, you know, more questions raised and you're going to need more data to answer those questions.
That's right. So that's why I was considering your question, well, do you get just overwhelmed by all the stuff you don't know? No, because I think you kind of dive into it. And as you ponder this particular question, more things come up. Often there's surprises. You think you know what the data is going to be. You think you know what's going to come out of it. And sometimes you get a little bit of that. But often you get a surprise. And now you have to figure out, well, is there something about my methodology, something I did with the analysis that screwed up the result? Or is this fundamentally a shift in what I thought was true, and now I need to rearrange my understanding of the topic?
How often does that latter happen? Is it more a methodology problem when that happens? Or how often are people really finding new things or new ways to think about things?
I think it depends on how mature the topic is. If it's a topic, you know, a lot of people have been working on things. If you come up with something utterly new, chances are, and most people aren't agreeing with you, chances are good that there's some hiccup in the analysis. And it could be a computer issue, a modeling issue. It could be the way that you analyze the raw data. But if a field is fairly young, then it's surprising sometimes what we didn't know. Then lots of surprises happen. Let me give you an example for, I'm thinking of asteroids. We've been sending now for the last, let's say 20 years or so, we've been sending a few. There's a handful now of machines that have gone to an asteroid or close to an asteroid, and we've seen it from the outside, reasonably close up. Until then, we thought that asteroids are rocky materials, potato-shaped, pretty dense. I mean, not obviously as dense as Earth, but the density of stone. When you get close up to some of them, you realize, no, this is more like a pile of rubble. And really what's keeping it together is its own gravity. This was unexpected. So that's the kind of insight you get with, as I said, new data.
And that is, of course, what shifts thinking and sometimes new theories arise.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Very exciting.
It is.
It is very exciting. And it, to me, I'm just so impressed by people who want to do this because it's such painstaking work.
Yes.
You know, we like to think of, you know, the eureka moment, but there's usually years and years of work that go into a eureka moment.
Yes.
We
yes.
just don't see that.
That's right. That's not glamorous. But I think to get to those epiphanies, you really do need to spend the time. One of my favorite aha moments, a moment of a scientist, and I don't remember his name now, but it's the story doesn't suffer for it. He's sitting in a cafeteria and he's watching this food fight break out. And most people would, worry about how they're going to keep their composure and perhaps save their clothes from getting messed up. But what he noticed was that as the food was flying, the ketchup was behaving in a different way than everything else. Because he had the information, because he had thought about the viscosity and texture of ketchup, he was able to study it, and it basically became the foundation for some of the seminal work he did and picked up a Nobel Prize as a result. So sometimes the data is staring you in the face, but you don't necessarily have the appreciation to ask the question, well, why is that? I would expect this, and instead it's doing that. So it can give you that magic moment of, you know, the epiphany.
So don't be afraid of food fights or put ketchup on your burgers. Well, Jean Creighton, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll catch up with you next month.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Bonnie.
Regular Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She spoke with us this month about the collection, analysis, and publication of scientific data. We'll take one last break, and then essayist Mark Segrist is moving and finding it hard to find his get up and go. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. It's been so cold these past few days, we're all practically frozen in place. But Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist has some actual moving to do, and he's fighting his own sort of inertia.
I moved a lot as a kid. It's never easy. My dad worked in media and government, so my sisters and I got to see our share of the country. Not on vacation, but literally on the move. Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Milwaukee, Los Angeles, the list goes on. We used to kid our mom a lot about keeping so much stuff in brown paper bags. Now I get it. She was always ready. I took a page out of her playbook 2 years ago. That's when I sold my house and took an apartment. I decided then to keep a lot of my own stuff boxed up, well-labeled, and ready to go. That walk-in closet came in handy. But my gypsy confidence didn't last long. With another recent move fast approaching, I broke down and tore those boxes wide open. It wasn't so much curiosity as it was a need to lighten my load. A cleansing of the spirit was in order, plus the movers I hired were working by the hour. The box marked Christmas decorations was first, from tiny lights to figurines. Sorting through it called for decisive action, but weeding out the cast of characters from the classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer TV special was rather painful. Like pulling teeth. Hermie the Misfit Elf? My dentist might appreciate him. What about Charlie in the Box? Never did like clowns. Maybe. Yukon Cornelius, the old prospector? He's pretty loud. I wouldn't miss the Bumble that much either. How did a snow monster get the name Bumble anyway? All right, it's taking way too long. I haven't even finished the Island of Misfit Toys yet. Get back in the box, guys. You're all coming with me. Let's take another look at that to-do list now. Post office, change of address form, cable company, disconnect the internet, bank, new checks, movers, bigger truck, grocery store, extra brown paper bags. Mom, I hope you're enjoying this. Moving on is never easy.
Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist is a freelance television producer in Milwaukee whose work appears on Milwaukee Public Television and in other outlets. His children's book, Smoochy Dog Earns a Badge, has recently been published as well. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Milwaukee Magazine takes on the economics of the same-sex marriage debate in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll have an Oscar preview ahead of the awards on Sunday. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for listener-supported Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.